from KCPW in Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Occasionally, you still see them around town, especially after a heavy snow. The purple or red or yellow parkas that people wore as volunteers during the 2002 Winter Games here in Salt Lake City. It's just one small reminder of the goodwill, the community pride, and the Olympic party that came to town 10 years ago this month. Hard to believe it's been a decade since roots berets were the dominant fashion trend and downtown buildings were plastered with massive images of celebrated athletes. Today on the program, we're remembering Salt Lake's Olympic dream and the legacy of the Games with gold medalist Derek Parra and former Salt Lake Olympic CEO Fraser Bullock. Plus, discovering the eclectic history of the avenues. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. February 2002, a magical time to be in Salt Lake City. 2,500 athletes from 77 countries came to Utah to test their physical limits, and if you were here, you know it was all about world record performances and medal ceremonies and pin trading and celebrating in the streets. And just to keep things exciting, the Games had its share of scandals, too. Today on the program, we're reflecting on the triumphs, the low points, the legacy of the 2002 Winter Olympics here in Salt Lake City. With us this hour, Fraser Bullock. He is the founder and managing director of Sorensen Capital. He's also the former COO of the Salt Lake Organizing Committee for the 2002 Winter Games, and he joins me here in studio. And Fraser Bullock, thanks very much for your time today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Also with us, Derek Parra. He won both gold and silver medals in speed skating in the 2002 Games. He also set a world record in the 1500 meters and an American record in the 5000. He's currently Outreach Youth Programs Director at the Utah Olympic Oval in Kearns, and he's the author of the book Reflections in the Ice. And Derek Parra, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Beginning February 8th, the city will be offering a series of events commemorating the 10-year anniversary of the 2002 Winter Olympics, starting with the relighting of the cauldron. And there's more information at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Also a link on our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, we're profiling one of Utah's most diverse neighborhoods, the Avenues. A new book is out on that. But first, at the 2002 Winter Games, where were you when the Olympics came to town? What effect did the Games have on your life, your business, or the image of the state? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Derek, I want to start with you. Let's go back to 2002. You had recently switched from inline skating to speed skating. You had really struggled financially to make your Olympic dream a reality. And here you are, you're poised on the ice to skate the 1500 meters. Do you think about that moment 10 years later?
Yeah, it really seems like yesterday. I do a lot of motivational speaking now since the Games. And I just spoke about a month ago and to a group of youth. And I was crying up on the top of the, you know, top of the stage there, talking to him about just what it felt like. And I talked about my story, how I got there and all the struggles and the barriers and just what it was like just to actually finally be able to compete after it was, at that point, 18 years it took me to get there. So
So what was going on in your mind at that moment?
There was a lot of support from the American community that I had never felt before. I've been to Olympics in Nagano, Japan. But it was abroad. There was, as a speed skater, it's kind of a caveman sport in a way. We're in caves, we say. You know, we're up at 6 a.m. racing. You'd come into a facility after our competition. You wouldn't even know there was a competition. That's just the way our sport runs. It's always early in the morning. And so, after September 11th, there was a lot of found patriotism that was here in this country. And people were really backing the American team when we decided to continue to host the Games. And I remember leading in, not knowing what to think, not knowing about the safety of the Games, not knowing if I wanted to skate after September 11th. Just was really affected by that. And coming up into the Games, leading into the race, I had skated first of all, if I want to back up a little bit, I carried the World Trade Center flag into the opening ceremonies, which was a spiritual experience, an emotional experience I'll never forget. And that kind of sparked my performances going into the next day, which is the 5,000 meter where I set a world record, and it was ultimately beat by a Dutch skater, Joachim Oudehaaien, and that was my American record. And then I came back 10 liters and won the gold. And stepping on the ice, I just felt this this peace and this energy in the arena. I was excited. I was finally skating, doing what I wanted, had been wanting to do for 18 years. I just had a baby girl a few months earlier. I saw friends from in the stands that were there from the last 18 years of my life, from when I was in high school. It was just an amazing moment, and I was so proud that I was able to kind of block all that out and focus on that white sheet of ice for a minute and 43 seconds.
Minute 43. Is that what the Olympics is about? It's about personal victory. It's about struggle. It's about nationalism. All of those emotions wrapped into one?
I think it's a little bit of everything for everyone. Everyone's different. I mean, some people are going there with just wanting to compete. Some people are going there with a chance of or a hope they might have a great performance and get them on the podium. And there's a few that are there that truly believe they can win. And I had a little bit of everything there in my first race. I didn't know how I would do. I was never top 10 in that race, but I was so inspired by the opening ceremonies the night before that I came out and felt this presence on the ice that I had never felt before. And I wasn't alone out there. And I skated a world record in the 5K, and that just kind of exploded with our team. Everybody felt really inspired, and our other teams in the games, all the sports, hockey, figure skating, everything kind of rolled with it. We were all friends at that point. We've all known each other for a few years, and being at different events, and so our American team started rolling with it. And then when I came back for the 1500 meter, it was just that piece of being there. I don't know. It's so hard to explain, but you look back, like my book is called Reflections in the Ice, and when the starter said go to the start and I went down and saw my reflection in the ice, it's that spurred the book on. I just kind of looked at that and I told myself I am ready, and in a second, like my whole life flashed in front of my eyes and I was ready for that race and the gun went off.
Hmm. Fraser Bullock, it's easy to see an athlete's attraction to the Olympics. You're a businessman, a financier. What brought you into the Olympic family? Why did you join this cause?
Well, first of all, the Olympics is a wonderful example of human achievement. Derek is an Olympic superstar, and what you heard is what the Olympics is all about. And when we gather people from nations all around the world under the umbrella of sport in a peaceful movement to focus on human achievement, it inspires all of us. Now, what brought me into it was it was a troubled time where we just experienced a scandal, and Mitt Romney was brought on board, who is a fabulous, fabulous leader, and asked me to join him, which I reluctantly did. I hate to say that, but it was a very difficult time, but it was a time that was in need of a turnaround, and Mitt led that. So I joined him because what we wanted to focus on was eliminate any issue with scandal and instead focus on what Derek just talked about, which is inspiration, human achievement, and put the dark things in the past and focus on the future.
How hard was that? Because the games were tainted in a way by the bid scandal, $1 million in gifts and bribes and indictments. How hard was that to come in and to focus on the future and about that Olympic spirit and put that baggage behind you?
It was very challenging because we had a $400 million budget deficit and no new sponsors wanted to sign up for the games. In fact, a lot of sponsors wanted to leave because of the scandal and the taint associated with it. We also had a Justice Department investigation going on. So there are all these challenges that every place you turned, it was negative. However, Mitt came in, and he's a very inspirational leader, one that has incredible confidence of what's possible. He put together a great team of people, and under his inspirational leadership, we actually were able to pretty quickly say, we can do this. In spite of all these difficulties, we have the right leadership in place, we have the right person in place, and he formed a team that enabled us to focus on what was really important. So we felt the turnaround coming. in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Fraser Bullock. He is founder and managing director of Sorensen Capital, also former COO of the Salt Lake Organizing Committee for the 2002 Winter Games. Also in studio, Derek Parra. He is a gold and silver medalist from the 2002 Winter Olympics. And we're reflecting on the legacy of those games. If you had a part as a volunteer or as an attendant in one of the games, give us a call. We'd love to hear your memories. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Let's talk about some of the specific effects, the lasting impact of the 2002 Winter Olympics on this particular state, on this city. In terms of infrastructure, let's start there. How did the Winter Olympics change the way we get to work? How did it change the physical facilities that we have here? Fraser Bullock?
So first of all, we have the best Olympic venues in the world. We have the fastest ice on Earth, and Derek gets to skate there almost every day. And those venues are utilized at the highest level they've ever been used. There are hundreds of kids at the Speed Skating Oval, Utah Olympic Park. We see these facilities that are world-class that continue to be operated every day. And in fact, 40% of the U.S. athletes that competed in the Olympic Games in Vancouver last year, or in 2010, 40% lived and trained in Utah. So we have become a winter sports capital for the United States. The second thing that you see is a lot of infrastructure that came with the games in terms of highways and light rail. Now, some of those things weren't necessarily needed for the games, but they were accelerated and brought here. And so they really helped us in terms of being prepared with the infrastructure that we needed for the games. Third, we have this wonderful legacy, this reputation around the world now of having been able to put on extraordinary games where everything worked, where our, as Derek talked about, our U.S. team performed at an extraordinary level. Prior to Salt Lake, our high for winning medals in a Winter Games was 13. In these games, we won 34, which was just staggering. And Derek and Shannon Barkey are the ones that got it all started and cascaded from there. Just a remarkable achievement. So whether it's infrastructure of roads and highways, whether it's Olympic venues or great memories and a wonderful team achievement, we have a wonderful legacy.
Fastest ice on Earth. What makes the Utah Olympic Oval the fastest ice on Earth? Derek Parra.
It's a lot of environmental conditions. Like we have a great building where we're able to control the inner environment. And with the dry air here, the high altitude, the thin air, and with controlling the temperature in the building, it creates fast ice. There are two venues that are similar. That's Calgary from the 88 games and here in Salt Lake in Kearns. And we battled for world records, and we're ahead by one. Mm. So it is fast ice. But beyond the fast ice, what I think a sign of a true legacy from the games is our programs that we have now in both facilities. We've got so much of Utah youth in the buildings, in our programs, which is something I think that I'm not sure if it was in the mind when they built the facilities, because if you look around the world now, all the facilities that are being built for the Olympics are not used anymore for that purpose. They were either swap meet halls or a rodeo hall or something, and we're still using our venues for what they were built for, and that's what's great. And if you go up in the summer or even in the winter to the Olympic Park and anytime to the Kearns Olympic Oval, you'll see just hundreds and hundreds of kids in our programs, and hopefully, one of my dreams is to have the youth from this state be at the games one year in the future and be on top of that podium.
Mm. One of the big selling points for the community embracing the Olympics the way it did was the promise of economic benefit. It did look like we got a bit of a bump for a little while, but the direct economic benefits, sort of petered out by 2003. Have there been indirect economic benefits from your vantage point, Fraser Bullock?
Yes, the direct benefits were really building up of the infrastructure where we hired all kinds of companies and things like that. But the indirect benefits are, first of all, skier days are up 46% since the games, and they really received a bump and continue to have that benefit as our great mountains and great ski resorts got exposed to the world. And there's a multiplier effect on that. So tourism is way up. Second of all, we have the national governing bodies of all the winter sports seem to have relocated to Utah. So these are like the speed skating team has moved here. We have bobsled and skeleton. So we really have become that winter sports capital. Third is we have corporations that have moved here, like Amherst Sports has moved their U.S. headquarters here, which is a very big corporation up in Ogden, and Rossignol, all these winter sports related companies, we've now become a magnet for them. And so we see a larger employment base as Utah has become exposed to the world, beginning with the 2002 Games.
What do you think the Games did for the state's image, both outside to the, you know, the outside world thought we were kind of a quirky backwater kind of place, and that image of ourselves as Utahns? How did the Olympics affect our mentality of who we are as Utahns? Fraser Bullock, do you have any ideas?
Well, we were relatively unknown in many parts of the world as I traveled either to Asia or Eastern Europe or different places. Many people had not heard of Utah. And then we had the scandal, which then all of a sudden we became known worldwide, but in the wrong sense. In fact, Mitt Romney and I went down to the Sydney Games in 2000 to visit and try to see, learn from their operations. And as we were walking through the crowd one night for a torch relay, they saw our shirts that had Salt Lake 2002 on them. And they abused us.
The Scarlet Letter.
Yeah, it was not fun. And so we had that reputation that needed to be turned around. Through the wonderful performances of the athletes, through the great success of the games, that everything worked, our mountains were picturesque, our people were the friendliest in Olympic history, all those legacies then completely changed our image. And we became known as not only an Olympic city, but having done the Olympic Games at a world-class level. In fact, Jean-Claude Keeley, who's an Olympic icon, won 3 gold medals, said, "Salt Lake, we will always remember you. These were perfect games." That's our brand around the world today. We're well-known, and we're well-known for having put on world-class games.
Derek Parra, you're from L.A. Had you heard of Utah or Salt Lake City before you came here to train?
Not really. I mean, I was in a summer sport for years, so I've lived around the country. I lived in Florida, Maryland, Delaware, Wisconsin, and when I came here, I was so focused on performance. I was living in a bubble, so to speak. I'd drive down the mountain, go to the rink, go to work, go drive up the mountain. That was my day. I never really went outside of those highway pathways. And so when I first went downtown during the games, I was just blown away at the spirit that was there, the people in the streets, the pin trading, all of the hoopla from the games. And I stuck around here. I now Utah is my home. I live down in Draper, and I really fell in love with the city. Just the people. There's still that bit of that spirit here from the games. I think it's great that to be a part of the Utah Olympic Oval, where you can try and share that spirit that we had here 10 years ago to the youth that's coming out. It's a great place to live, and I think people that I've met over the years, even when I was coaching and after I retired from skating, there were a lot of people who were asking about Utah, other Olympians, other people from different sports, and they've come here, they've tried it, they never really heard about it before, and they really enjoy the time here.
We're remembering the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. Our guest, Derek Parra, a gold and silver medalist during those games. Also with us, Fraser Bullock, former COO of the Salt Lake Organizing Committee. If you'd like to join us with your memories of the games 10 years out, 801-355-TALK is our number. This Wednesday night at 6:30, Olympic and Paralympic heroes will relight the Olympic cauldron at Rice-Eccles Stadium at the University of Utah. There are other festivities planned throughout the month. Go to our website, kcpw.org, for more information. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. It's been a decade since Salt Lake City realized its Olympic dream, but the memories are alive and well. Today on the program, we're recapping highlights of the 2002 Winter Olympics, noting the upcoming 10th anniversary, and exploring the possibility of bringing another Winter Games to town. Our guests are Derek Parra, a gold and silver medalist in speed skating at the 2002 Olympics, and Fraser Bullock, the former COO of the Salt Lake Organizing Committee. And you are very welcome to join us as well with your thoughts, memories, comments. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. What do you think the Olympics did for Utah's economy or its image? If you were a volunteer in 2002 or you saw Derek Parra on the ice, we'd love to hear your stories. 801-355-8255. Let's talk about the anniversary events. Fraser Bullock, it's been 10 years. I mean, does it seem like 10 years? Is that possible? Are you constantly reminded of what you were able to pull off in 2002?
It does not seem like 10 years. In fact, I was pulling out the Olympic videos over the weekend to watch them again and just remind myself. And some of the memories are so vivid, it seems like yesterday, because they were so important, at least to many people, that they become imprinted on your mind, and you just they're vivid and you can remember them. And it's so many good memories.
Mm-hmm. How are you marking this 10-year anniversary?
Well, we have several celebrations. Various communities are doing things. For example, Park City has already had a celebration. Kearns has one coming up on February 17th. The signature events are really begin this Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. at Rice-Eccles Stadium. We're going to attempt to relight the cauldron.
What do you mean attempt?
Well, it's 10 years old. We're working on it. We're going to do some tests today, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to burn it for at least a short period of time. Mm-hmm. So that will be commemorating the 10-year anniversary of opening ceremonies. Then really the key day is February 18th, where we'll have an outdoor winter carnival, Olympic festival, at the Gateway beginning at 10 a.m. till 4 p.m., and that's Saturday, February 18th. But then our really capstone and key to the whole celebration is at Energy Solutions Arena, February 18th at 7 p.m., where we're going to have a tribute to 2002 featuring Stars on Ice. We'll have Sarah Hughes there, who will perform. We have Mitt Romney there. We've been able to get him off the campaign trail to come and join us and recall the great memories. Derek will be there, many Olympians. And so and we'll show videos from the games. We will have many skaters performing, former Olympians. It'll be a great celebration. And we encourage people to get their tickets at SmithsTix and join us in that celebration.
We'll put a link on our website, kcpw.org. In many ways, the 2002 Winter Olympics, it brought a heightened profile for many sports, including speed skating. I think that was one particular sport that really caught fire after the 2002 Olympics. It was the first games for Apollo Ohno, mm-hmm. who's now a superstar. What are some of the other effects on the sporting community, on winter athletics, that raise the profile here in Salt Lake City? Derek Parra?
Well, I think that, you're right. You're definitely hitting the nail on the head with speed skating. We're one of the most watched sports during the games, for those 17 days during the games every 4 years, but it's the time in between where you mm-hmm. don't really see a lot of speed skating. So with Apollo's success or really with his Dancing on the Stars success, really brought him to the forefront of stardom. And he continued again and had a great performance in Vancouver. But if you look around at all the sports that are here now in Utah, I mean, I'm not sure how Utah was before the games, but you see a lot of kids getting into winter sports now. We see some speed skaters, hockey players, figure skaters up in at the park in Park City. They have a new mini slope style course up at the park, and there are just tons of kids that come out, and they're into that new form of skiing. And I love this town mainly because of that. I mean, you go up in the mountains and you're skiing or snowboarding in the winter, or you're out in the summer riding your bike, you see a lot of activity. And so I think the focus on winter sports has grown since the games, because they saw a sport at its best is true sport at its best here. And I think that, that spirit kind of bled into the community, and the kids and the parents that were around here have gotten their kids into that because of it.
And winter sports were never really known as American-dominated, I think, until Salt Lake City. That a lot of sports really caught fire, like snowboarding. We had kind of our first exposure to curling. I mean, who knew what that was? So in a way, it was an educational event as well. Fraser?
Yes, it really was a breakout games for the United States, and the people that watched them because of the great performance of our team was just stunning. I remember the U.S. Olympic Committee was hoping that they might be able to get 20 medals. That was the goal for their games, which seemed pretty audacious because the previous high was 13. To get 34 was staggering, and that's why it was a breakout games for Winter Olympic sports, because we saw so many champions and so many people achieve so well that that legacy has now continued on in Torino and Vancouver. It really was a game changer for the U.S. team.
Mm-hmm. The games certainly were not without controversy. I'm thinking of the South Koreans who protested a disqualification of a World Cup champion speed skater. Derek Parrott, did that shake up the U.S. team at all? Did that kind of divert your focus momentarily?
No, I mean, I think it really was more of Apollo's concern. He was in that in those events, but short track is just in like any other sport. It's as a long track skater, we're going against the clock. So it's the fastest person of the day that wins. Where in short track, it's the first person across the line. So the speeds vary. For us, it's a time trial. So we at long trackers, we always say short track's like rolling the dice. You don't have to be the fastest; you have to be the luckiest as well. And calls are made after the race. You never know what can happen, and that's just part of short track. I mean, Apollo got knocked down, got a silver, and there was Stephen Bradbury from Australia who was almost a half lap behind, and everybody went down, and he got first. He won the gold. So it's just a crazy sport. I think the American culture really likes it because of that aspect, but as an athlete, you're really trying to focus on your performance, and you trained for years and years, and I know from my experience that regardless of what's going on around you, you could have everything going on, whether it's family, at the games, media shooting at you. It's a firestorm of things all happening at one time. You've got to be able to focus and execute. And I think that's what skaters or athletes were doing. No matter what happened, you just had to focus on your event and then kind of deal with that stuff afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Probably the highest profile scandal during the games was the two gold medal winners in the free skate pairs competition, the Canadians Jamie Soleil and David Pelletier. Anyway, my French not so good. Were awarded gold medals along with the Russians because of a scandal with one of the French judges. Did that shake you as organizers of the games, thinking, "Oh my goodness, this is going to taint the games in some way"? Fraser Bullock.
It was very unfortunate, and Mitt and I knew an injustice had been done, as well as the entire viewing public. and it was Jacques Roga, he's the president of the IOC, it was his first games. Mitt and I went and saw Jacques and said, "You need to fix this." Even though we had nothing to do with it as the organizing committee, we just set the stage, and then the athletes and the judges fill the stage. But we said, "This injustice needs to be taken care of." To Jacques' credit, he worked with the International Skating Union and said, "You need to fix this." And so the gold was awarded to Jamie and David, and I'm delighted to report that they're going to be joining us here for our celebration on February 18th, so we can see them perform once again. They had a once-in-a-lifetime skate that they did to win the gold medal, and we're delighted to have them back.
Oh, that's great. You mentioned several times Mitt Romney's role in turning around the 2002 Winter Olympics, rescuing what was scandal-ridden and making it into a success. He, of course, later became governor of Massachusetts. He's now a front runner in the Republican candidacy for president. At 10 years ago, when he was running the Olympics, did you foresee any of this political success when you worked with him at SLOC, or I guess my question is, how much of his recent success do you think it can be traced back to the success of the Salt Lake Games?
Quite a bit, actually. And what I've known Mitt actually since 1980 in prior career experiences.
You were together at Bain Capital.
At Bain and Company, and then Bain Capital. And what I became familiar with is Mitt is an absolutely extraordinary, brilliant leader. He is the real deal, and our country could benefit by his leadership. But it's a series of things that Mitt did to prepare himself, starting with his education at Harvard, both law and MBA, and then at Bain Company, Bain Capital. And then the Olympics, I think, changed things for him in terms of being able to work through security issues, work through being able to handle all kinds of different constituent groups, different countries, different teams, that and gave him a profile outside of the business community to be able to do very significant things. Interestingly enough, I went back through my journals that I wrote during that, and I remember halfway through I wrote in there, this guy should be president. Now, I never said anything to him, but then about...
You might want to hang on to that.
Yeah, hang on to that. But then I remember about 6 months before the games, because we were all going to get fired at the Olympics. You hire everybody, and then we fire everybody, and we're going to get fired. And I said, well, Mitt, what are you going to do after the games? And he said, it doesn't really matter. What we have to do is get this right. Let's focus on this, and the future will take care of itself. Mm. And that was his approach. And he's such an extraordinary leader. I'm just grateful that he asked me to help him.
Well, I guess the same question I would ask of you personally. How did the Olympics kind of shape how you've spent the last 10 years? Derek Parra first.
Well, before I joke around with people saying before the games, I worked at the Home Depot as part of the job opportunities program there, and I could have set myself on fire in the electrical aisle and no one would have known. I mean, it's amazing how that one moment in time does change your life. And I was the same person before and after that race. It's just that, you know, I had success in that race. And what I felt that was really strange and awkward was, you know, before, at the time I was married, before I couldn't get my wife to listen to me. So, and after the race, you know, I'm speaking to companies and groups, and they wanted to hear how I got there. And I think one of the greatest things about the games is who you become on the road to the Olympics. I mean, I've went through so many things in my life where I was, you know, eating out of trash cans to, you know, struggling to make rent, and people came into my life who were going out on a date so I can babysit their children so I can make some money just to kind of to keep on that journey, stay on that path. And after, when it's all over and you look back, it's such a rewarding experience to see where you've come just as a human being, and to see, you know, what I think the spirit, where the spirit can take you.
Mm. Fraser Bullock, you mentioned earlier in the program you were hesitant to come on board the Olympic effort in 2002. Would you do it again? Any regrets?
Not for a second. Back then, it was very dark, and Mitt described it like stepping into an empty elevator shaft. He was right. But what I became converted to was the Olympic movement and the Olympic family, and understand the ideals that it represents. And particularly in our country's history, this was at a very important moment shortly after 9/11, where it became a healing moment for our country and in some sense for the world. And so in and of itself, the Olympic movement is very unique in the entire world. But then it took on special meaning. So being a part of that, being a part of the Olympic family, I continue to stay involved in the Olympic movement because I think it is a very, very valuable movement to our country and to the world.
Our time is running short, but there has been talk about making another bid for the Olympics here in Salt Lake City for the 2022 Games. Your thoughts as insiders? I'm wondering if you think that's a good idea. First, Derek?
Oh, I would love to see a Games back here in Salt Lake City just because of what kind of energy there is there, what that spirit, the Olympic spirit is so unlike anything else I've experienced in my life. And I've been a part of that movement for so long that I would love to have the youth here experience that. And it will take you to places you've never, it's so inspiring. I can't imagine having an Olympics in my own backyard, and I would love it if it came here again.
Fraser, what are the chances?
Well, the chances are reasonable at some point in the future. The question, I think, is timing, because cities for Winter Olympic Games are very hard to have because you have to have a large city, you have to have mountains close, and so there are very few cities that qualify across the world. So it does make sense for them to rotate back to the United States and likely to Salt Lake at some point in the future, particularly with the infrastructure that we have in place. Our only liability is that we just had them 10 years ago, and the IOC likes to see the games move around a lot. But having them at some point in the future, I think, is a high probability.
Mm-hmm. Give us one more time the website for more information about the upcoming 10th anniversary events.
You can go to saltlake2002.com. It lists all the events, and you can buy tickets to the great celebration on February 18th.
Fraser Bullock, former COO of the Salt Lake Organizing Committee, also the founder and managing director of Sorensen Capital. Fraser, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
And Derek Parra, gold and silver medalist in speed skating in the 2002 Olympics, author of the book Reflections in the Ice. And Derek, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Thanks. I really encourage everyone to come out to the 18th celebration. If you were part of Utah, it would be a great time to come back and relive that. If you weren't around then, or if you were too young to remember, come out and experience a night of celebration and remembrance of what took place here in the city. You won't be disappointed.
And again, this Wednesday night at 6:30, the cauldron will be relit at the University of Utah. On Saturday, February 18th, a number of events are going to be held in honor of the 10th anniversary. More information on our website, kcpw.org. Up next, the history of the Avenues neighborhood. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The grid system mapped out by Brigham Young shapes every neighborhood in Salt Lake City except one, the Avenues. With its mansions, Victorians, and bungalows, the Avenues remains an eclectic and diverse neighborhood with an independence all its own. A new book documents the neighborhood's historical beginnings, and joining me now to talk about the architecture and the people who shaped the Avenues, Savan Lesueur. Am I saying that right?
Yes, you are.
Okay. The author of the recently published historical photo book, The Avenues, Images of America. It recounts and illustrates the changes of Salt Lake's historical neighborhood through the years. And he's currently at work on a second book scheduled to be published by University of Utah Press this fall.
Yes.
Savan Lesueur joins me in studio. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Kirk Huffaker. He's the executive director of the Utah Heritage Foundation and an adjunct instructor at the University of Utah, where he teaches city and metropolitan planning. And Kirk, welcome to you.
Good morning.
If you have questions or comments about the Avenues, if you live in the Avenues, tell us why. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Savan, before we get to some of the stories in your book, you grew up in East Mill Creek.
Yes.
You lived away for quite a number of years. You came back and decided to settle in the Avenues. Why the Avenues?
I think I was always attracted to the architecture and just how different it was from the rest of the city. My father introduced me to history at a young age, and we drove around a lot to see old neighborhoods, and I just kind of sucked it in from a young age. So when I grew up and I had an opportunity to move back to Salt Lake City and find a home, just the Avenues met the criteria that my wife and I were looking for. We wanted the diversity. We wanted the diversity in architecture, and we just wanted something a little different.
Mm-hmm. Kirk, what does set the Avenues apart from other neighborhoods with historic homes? There are historical neighborhoods across the state, really. What sets the Avenues apart?
Well, it truly is the diversity that's there. Where, you know, we look at historic significance from a standpoint of age and style of architecture, the Avenues really typifies what we look for in one of these neighborhoods that get listed on the National Register, and the Avenues was one of the first in the state.
Mm. Savan, your book highlights many of the people and the structures that you find in the Avenues and the history. You note that it was not an easy place to build. I mean, it's got slopey hillsides, lack of water.
Yes. In the early days, it was referred to as the dry bench because Salt Lake City, although it was really one of the first planned residential neighborhoods, Salt Lake City wasn't very good at getting resources to the neighborhood in terms of water specifically. And several water projects in the late 19th century helped expand the Avenues northward. and higher up on the bench. But with every street that went further north, it was another challenge for the city to get water there. Initially, the first water came from City Creek Canyon, from City Creek, and was part of the everything was related to the wards, the church structure, mm-hmm. and it was part of the ward irrigation system. And so, yeah, development was slow, and it continued from 1860 to into 1930 on empty lots. And as a result, that's what brought the neighborhood such diverse architecture, where you could have a Victorian next to a bungalow, next to a 1920s cottage.
Sure. I want to get to the diversity in the architecture in a moment, but demographically, who were some of the first settlers of the avenues?
The first settlers, of course, were LDS. The first land grants were given by Brigham Young, mostly in what is presently the western portion of the avenues. And each block was split up into four pieces of land and granted to various individuals. But that changed rapidly as the city grew. The area became popular with persons working in the mining industry, the railroads, and merchants. And so even from the earliest times, you started to see more diversity in this neighborhood than you did in the rest of the city, more non-LDS population than you would find in other portions of Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. So it followed the trend of LDS to more of a mixed religious atmosphere.
It was interesting that you noted that the religious diversity kind of reflected some of the architectural diversity in that neighborhood as well. Maybe describe some of the structures that we see in the avenues that have remained.
Well, I think two of the only older churches have remained. The 27th Ward, which is on P Street, is an excellent example of a early 20th century LDS church structure. It's great to have in the neighborhood because the other original churches that the Mormon Church built were all demolished in the 1970s. You also have the Danish Evangelical Lutheran Church on First Avenue, which was the only non-LDS church built in the neighborhood. Another unique thing in the avenues, and you find this also in other older neighborhoods around the country, is the corner grocery stores. Mm. You still have a few of them remaining in the neighborhood, and some of them have been converted into residences.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Savan LeSueur. He's author of the recently published book, The Avenues, Images of America. Also with us, Kirk Huffaker, executive director of the Utah Heritage Foundation. If we're talking about the avenues, if you live there, if you used to live there, we'd love to hear from you. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Kirk Huffaker, can you talk about the architectural styles that we see in the avenues? As diverse as as the residents have been, you see that many styles of homes in the avenues.
Yeah, absolutely. And really that continues today. So where we started out in the Pioneer era, you do have some of that representation of the earliest times in Salt Lake City with adobe construction. And very early styles such as the Greek Revival that took many years to migrate here from the East Coast and get used. And really it only got used as a style for a very short period of time because we immediately entered the Victorian era. That's really a dominant style, I would say, in the avenues. You see it in all sizes and types of houses. You can have a very small cottage that's a Victorian style to a very large, what we really call a mansion today, that is very intricate in its detail. It moved on quickly to the bungalow styles, arts and crafts movements, period revival, and really into the post-war period. There were still some lots available, and large lots, some divided into smaller lots. So you do have some post-war period buildings that we would consider significant today.
Mm-hmm. Savan, your book is chock full of old photographs. It must have been great fun to go through some of the archives and see what these early homes look like, and probably, I would imagine, you're driving through the avenues now and kind of comparing notes, seeing how they have changed.
Yes, we're very fortunate to have the resources that the state has at their state history library. They have an excellent photographic collection, and it's very searchable on the internet or down at their library at the Rio Grande Depot. So, yes, it was a pleasure, and it seemed like every time that I that I went through the photo collections, I would discover something new, and that's very rewarding as someone who enjoys history and enjoys architecture.
Mm-hmm. You noted that a few very prominent people lived in the avenues. We talked a little bit about religious diversity, mm-hmm. but the avenues can claim some very some of the higher ups in the LDS Church. I'm thinking of President Heber J. Grant, also Utah Governor William Spry, probably best known for his refusal to overturn the death penalty for Joe Hill, the labor organizer. Talk about some of the other prominent individuals that you came across in your research who called the avenues home.
I think one of the people that always comes to my mind because I drive by her former house every day is Dr. Ellis Shipp. She was sent to Salt Lake City from American Fork at the age of 18. To live in the Lion House as, quote, one of Brigham Young's children, is how it was described in the books. But she became a polygamous wife a few months later, and one of her sister wives was sent to the Philadelphia Women's College to study medicine, and she dropped out. So Dr. Shipp went there and took up the education. She came back to Utah, helped establish the Deseret Hospital, and she spent her life training women, nurses, midwives in medicine, and had a significant impact in early medicine in the state. She went to rural communities in Utah and Idaho and taught women. And during most of this time, she lived in a home on First Avenue.
Hmm. Another high-profile woman that you note in your book is Alice Horn, moved to the avenues, 868 Second Avenue, and she operated an art gallery out of her home. And I see, as you drive through the avenues, there is kind of an artistic flair, a tradition of artists coming to this neighborhood.
Yeah, again, that is one of the fun things that I've discovered is that you look at the avenues as kind of an arts community, and again, it started early on. Alice Horn, as you said, she was a pioneer in the art community in Utah. She also helped establish the LDS Church's youth program, primary program, and so it's just one example of the avenues being arts related from an early age.
Mm-hmm. Kirk Huffaker, I think that the avenues now has a reputation as a place where people want to restore some of these historic homes, but it wasn't always that way. There were a number of structures over the years that have been torn down, and I'm thinking of in Savan's book, the tower. I can't remember the name of it, but there was kind of a lookout point.
Anderson Tower.
Anderson Tower. Why the renewed interest in restoring these older homes, do you think?
Well, you know, certainly I think people recognize that this is a real community, that there is a sense of place to this neighborhood, and they want to be a part of it, much like Savan and his family. You know, they have certain parameters in mind about where they want to live, who they want to interact with, and really what they're looking for out of where they live. So, you know, the avenues, with its proximity to downtown, mix of affordable and large houses. You know, there's really something for everyone here. There's never been an accusation that this is not an inclusive place. If anything, this is one of the most active neighborhoods, I think, both physical activity with proximity to the foothills, politically active, active with your neighbors. You know, this is a place where you know your neighbors. And so it certainly transcends the architecture, but I think the architecture also helps foster that relationship in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Savan, as you researched and wrote your book, have your perceptions of the neighborhood changed in any way?
I wouldn't say they've changed. It just reinforced the feelings I had about the neighborhood and how much I love the avenues. And as a resident of the avenues, and just to agree with Kirk, what he says is I can't think of a place where you know your neighbors so well. I mean, I trust my neighbors. I know everybody on my block. And with the houses so close together and the smaller blocks, and lots of times these homes don't even have driveways, it really fosters a tight community. And again, learning the history of the neighborhood just reinforced it, and I think it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm. The debate continues. There's a current debate going on in the city about allowing adjacent structures, and I imagine that the avenues will have its voice heard on this particular issue. Are you hearing your neighbors talking about it, Savan?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really voice an official position of leaders in the avenues, but I think there's a lot of opposition to it. People, I don't know if the vision that city government has is what happened in the past, but there's enough people in the avenues that remember one of the things that really damaged the neighborhood was encouraging multifamily housing. And I think people look at it with adjacent, you know, adding rooms to your home or live-in type structures that's a step backwards for the neighborhood.
Savan LeSueur, he is the author of the recently published historical photo book, The Avenues, and it recounts and illustrates the changes of this historical neighborhood. He is presenting, is it a lecture, a seminar?
It's going to be, I'm just going to go through the photos of some of the photos from this book and the next book coming out, and just give a history of the neighborhood for anybody that's interested.
And that's happening this Thursday, February 9th at 6:30 at the Suite Library Branch. That's 9th Avenue and F Street. Also with us, Kirk Huffaker, the executive director of the Utah Heritage Foundation. And gentlemen, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Tamara Kemsley and Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Next time, a recent CDC survey shows some gaps in knowledge among teen parents in Utah, which leads to the question, what are kids learning about sex in public schools? Join us for that discussion tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.